Winning the battle within. The perfect swing is the one you trust.
This is Golf Smarter. Each week, we tap the minds of PGA and USGA course pros, architects, authors, and teaching gurus to provide you with tips, drills, insights, and advice so that you can lower your scores. Golf Smarter is brought to you by Edwin Watts Golf, golf's most trusted retailer since 1968. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome, and thank you for downloading another episode of the Golf Smarter podcast. A couple of pieces from last week's show from the PGA Expo that I'd like to correct. First of all, I didn't mention that all of the companies that were featured in the interviews, you can find their web address URLs in the show notes. And if you missed previous explanation, I try to put a lot of information on the show notes that you can review, so let's spend a moment on how to review the show notes. If you listen at golfsmarterpodcast.com, the notes can be scrolled through as you're listening. If you listen in iTunes, next to the description, there's an I in a circle. Click on that, and you'll be able to read all the notes. And lastly, if you're listening right now on your iPod, not the shuffles because they have no screen, but if your iPod has a screen, go ahead right now and click on that center button. Click once, and you'll see a timeline with a diamond in it, which allows you to rewind or fast forward. And please, don't fast forward. Don't want to do that. The next click should display a full screen of the podcast logo, and one more click will take you to all the show notes provided by the podcast producer. I spent a lot of time on that, so I hope you get to read that. Also, in last week's show notes, I forgot to put in headcoverleash.com. Sorry about that, but it is www.headcoverleash.com. And thanks to Mark Katz of Mannequin Sabot, Virginia. I don't know what Mannequin Sabot is. Is it like a Star Wars planet or something? Anyway, somewhere in Virginia, he took the initiative to find headcoverleash.com and make an order. Thanks for doing that from me and from the folks at Headcover Leash. Also, last week, I said the cost of a subscription to Sky Caddy is monthly. Actually, it's an annual subscription, so don't let that stop you from buying a Sky Caddy. But don't do it until you're absolutely sure you didn't win the Bushnell X500 rangefinder that we're giving away. Stay tuned for details on that. Thanks for letting me take care of that important business. Now, our guest is definitely an advocate and instructor of the inner game of golf, one of our favorite topics. His new book, called Winning the Battle Within, The Perfect Swing is the One You Trust, is a fascinating read. His name is Glenn Albaugh. Welcome, Glenn.
Hi, Fred.
How are you?
I'm great this morning.
Well, I'm so happy to have you on the show because I read your book, and thank you for sending me a copy, and thank you for signing it. And this book is so perfect for the Golf Smarter podcast. Just the title alone, Winning the Battle Within. The perfect swing is the one you trust. Now, how did you come up with the perfect swing is the one you trust? Is this something you've been saying for years and years?
Well, I've been saying it for years and years. I think it comes from this, let's say that somebody's a 15 handicap, and they have a swing that's relatively functional. It's the one they have. And so our suggestion is, okay, why not love your swing, embrace it, and if you trust the swing you have, regardless of what it is, it's going to be more functional. You're going to have more fun playing, and you're going to play better. So trusting your swing means to shut off any conscious thought and just let your swing go. Much like a skier lets his skis run, pointing downhill, much like the surfer when they get in the curl of the wave, much like the Randy Johnson when he throws his fastball 100 miles an hour. He just lets it go and trusts what he has.
What prevents us from doing that?
Well, we interfere ourselves. Two ways we interfere. One way is that if we think about how to swing, that can cause interference. And the second way is if we're not able to manage our emotions, and we allow negative emotions to come in, which is not unusual in golf because there's so many idle moments, such as, oh, my God, if I miss this one, what's going to happen? Or, oh, it's a triple press bet now. Or, I wonder how close I am to the cut line. Or, God, I wonder what Glenn will think when I tell him what, I've done on this hole. those are the kind of things that interfere. And if we can shut off you know, our conscious mind, you know, and if we can manage our emotions, we've got a chance to trust what we have.
But you talked about idle moments. You're right. There is so much of that in golf that it creates interference in our mind that I think is what we're battling all the time. And we talk about staying focused a lot, and we talk about being in the moment. But, of course, the moment of hitting a golf ball is only a few seconds, but there's so much time in between each of those strokes.
Yeah, we figure if you say we're playing a Saturday morning our foursome, and we're probably playing 4 hours, and we're probably engaged, totally engaged, maybe 10 minutes, you know, 4 hours. So what we do with the idle moments is are important, so that we can then, when it is our turn, you know, to play, to really be focused and give our full attention, you know, to that shot. As we prepare to hit a shot, and then we process the shot we just hit. We don't have to. It's not important to stay focused during the idle moments. There's some things we can do, you know, to make the day more enjoyable as we manage ourselves. But yeah, we're only engaged maybe for 10 minutes. Totally engaged.
Mm. Unless you're with somebody you really like and you have something to talk about.
Well, some people, you know, it depends. As Mike Murphy says in Golf in the Kingdom, you know, golf was made for walking. If we can enjoy the times in between in golf, we can enjoy the times in between in life. And so if you walk when you play, which I certainly advertise, it's a great time to be with yourself and enjoy the ambiance, enjoy the environment, you know, feel the grass on your feet, feel the wind, look to the tops of the trees. And then some people feel that they really need to ride in a cart, and sometimes you engage in conversation if you like to, or you can be silent, or you can say, I think I'll walk to the next shot. But anyway, managing ourselves during the idle moments so we can, you know, be focused for each shot is an important skill to acquire.
I find that I do remember a golf course much better when I'm walking. When I'm in a cart, it seems like I'm just going to my ball hit, go to the ball hit, and I miss the golf course.
Well, yeah, there's a rhythm, you know, and a tempo that we can acquire when we walk, which is that I enjoy very much.
Does having a engaging playing partner, whether it's someone you like or you just met, but you have a good conversation, a good rapport going with them, is that a distraction to your game, or is that helpful to keep you coming back and forth into the game, do you think?
Well, you know, we can't choose who our partner is going to be. And sometimes we might be fortunate to have a conversation that really enhances our play, and then sometimes that's not the case. For example, I was playing at Stockton Country Club, where I play often, and we have a six-some, and we've got a game going, you know, like everybody does. And I'm playing with one of my friends, and I know that he has a reputation of not using great positive self-talk. So we're on he hits a nice drive in the first hole, and he has about a 7-iron in, and hits a shot. It's, you know, not a bad shot. And it the pin was tucked kind of left and in front, and it missed the green, and it bounced and went in the trap. And he says, oh, man, here it goes again. You know, it's the same stuff over and over again. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, Frank, he had a pretty good shot. And, you know, you're 12 handicapped, so you're going to miss some. And that was pretty nice. Hit it solid, a little bit offline. Let's get ready and go for the next shot. Now, I know then for the rest of the day, and I'm riding in the cart with him, that I'm going to get that. He's going to be talking that way. So I have to decide then to maybe change his behavior or not allow what he says to affect the way I'm going to think and play. So we never really guaranteed who we get to play with relative to that kind of conversation. But we do, you know, we do have control the way we're going to think and the way we're going to focus, the way we're going to process shots, in the way that we're going to talk to ourselves. So it's not dictated upon what Frank says. It's dictated upon what we decide to do ourselves.
I wanted to talk about your resume for a minute. I mean, who is this guy, Dr. Glenn Albaugh, that we're talking to? Can you give us a little bit about your background, please?
I think I've been a coach, you know, Fred, since I was 2 years old. I can't remember a day where I've awakened and not trying to figure out some way to get squeeze some sports in. And in fact, today, you know, the only thing I'm going to get to do, and I'm going to get to work out a little later on, but sports have been central to my life forever. So as I grew older, I was able to coach basketball for 15 years, and then I went back to school. And I was very interested in sports psychology, and I was able to get a job in a university where I got to teach sports psychology, and I ended up at the University of Pacific. They needed a golf coach, so I said, well, I enjoy golf, and so I began to coach golf, and then that escalated and became, you know, took a great deal of my time, and I saw this really wonderful marriage, you know, between sports psychology and golf. And eventually that evolved into, you know, starting this consulting business in the early 90s. And now that's what I'm doing almost full time. I still do some things at the university with coaches and athletes, and I enjoy that immensely. And going back in time, I started playing golf when I was 14, and I started playing golf with Michael and Dennis Murphy in Salinas, California.
And we're talking about Michael Murphy of Golf in the Kingdom, Michael Murphy.
Yeah, Golf in the Kingdom, Michael Murphy. We started the Salinas High School golf team, you know, in 1947, something like that. And truthfully, Fred, we used to work in the summer and play, save our money until we got $5 and we could go down and play Pebble Beach. And then we play all day and with our tennis shoes on, carrying our clubs. I don't think we really knew what we were getting, you know, at the time. $5.
Did you really play for $5?
$5.
Oh.
And that was really high because everything else was about 50 cents. That's a long time ago.
Yeah, I guess so.
So Mike and Dennis was a younger brother. Mike was 1 year ahead of me. Dennis was 1 year behind. Dennis was probably the best player. I think he passed away last year. I think he won the Salinas City Championship, and Mike and I were just a step behind him, you know, as we learned to play, et cetera. So, yeah, we were friends growing up, you know, really close friends growing up. Anyway, that's a quick resume.
Well, at University of Pacific, you were the not only teaching sports psychology there, but you coached their golf team for how long?
I coached a golf team for 20 years. I didn't really count the first 5 years. We were just kind of getting started, and you know, but then it really escalated. We started getting some good players, and the program really took off, you know, in the late 70s.
And who are some of the players that came through the program that we'd recognize their names?
Well, let's see.
Not just golfers now.
Well, I think some people in the early part, Brian Peeney, who was a Northern California champion, I think 2 years running, was probably one of the really nice players, you know, coming through at that time.
Yeah, but come on, Glenn, you drop some bigger names in the book. You can do better. This is an international audience here listening to us. Give us some names that we, you know.
Oh, some of the people that are playing now?
Yeah, come on.
Oh, that I'm working with? Well,
come on, don't be modest.
Okay, well.
We're selling a book here.
Okay. Well, Scott McCarron.
There you go.
One of my lead guys. Right now, he's on a medical leave, but he's been one of my lead guys since 1993. Kurt Triplett, you know, the wonderful graduate of the University of Nevada, Reno, and he just had surgery on his right elbow, too. So he's off for the rest of the year. But they have all kinds of stories about both Kirk and Scott, you know, in the book. And I've already mentioned, you know, Jeff Brejo. And we have a couple of young guys that are out there chasing their card, you know, on the PGA Tour, Matt Hansen from Atwater and Roger Tambellini, who went to USC. and now I think he lives in Scottsdale. Those are some of the guys, among others.
You got a couple of ex-NFL buddies, but still recognizable names, at least that I see on the cover and the book. Bill Walsh.
Yeah, Bill Walsh has been my friend since college at San Jose State, and he and I both, we started coaching and teaching at the same high school, Washington High School in Fremont. I was a basketball coach, and Bill was a football coach, and we retained our friendship all these years. He gave me, you know, complete access to the 49ers in the 80s to help my own coaching education, which I also did at the University of Pacific and still do. And we remain friends forever. He's been, I think I've learned so much about practice and preparation, you know, from Bill, and a lot of that is in the book. You know, I borrowed lots of information from sport team coaches about, you know, the quality of practice and how to construct practices, which is certainly advantageous, you know, for golfers to learn. Bill, right now, I saw him last Thursday. He's playing the best golf of his life, and he says he owes it all to obviously to winning the battle within. That was nice of him to say that, huh?
Well, his quote is right on the front cover of the book. It says, one of the best books ever written on the mental approach to golf and sports performance. I'm curious, you talked about, I guess there must have been a really nice synergy going between the two of you in the fact that he was able to show you about preparation, and you were able to bring in the mental part of the game, which he was able to, I guess, bring to his team because his NFL team, the 49ers, they exceeded for years.
Well, yes, he certainly developed a dynasty there, you know, through his leadership. And so much of it had to do with the way they practiced. And the things that we learned that we can apply to golf is that practice should be structured. Practice should be, you know, have some, you know, three qualities in it. It should simulate competition situations. Obviously, you can practice your technique, but certainly not to the expense of preparing yourself for competition. And his practices were rigorous. His practices were extremely well organized. The practices were, you know, very detail conscious. And, you know, but in team sports such as football, you know, watching the 49ers practice in the 80s, they were so remarkably efficient, but they're supervised. You know, in golf, the golfer has to have the self-discipline to supervise themselves so they can make practice really productive. And I feel that probably golfers violate, you know, practice principles probably more than any other athletes because they really are by themselves. And they spend, I think, far too much time trying to develop technique rather than to really prepare themselves to, you know, for competition situations. But those are some of the things that I certainly learned from Bill and from people like Pete Carroll, you know, the USC coach, who was one of my students at the university, and we've done many things together, you know, over all of these years. And he, too, and if you watch a USC practice, the information you can gain from it, the speed of the practice, the tempo, the rhythm, and their absolute attention to all details relative to the thing that they are going to expect to do during competition. The golfer needs to do, you know, the same thing. And I feel in the book we talk a great deal about quality practice and some of the things that the golfer can do in order to maximize, you know, their own talents so that they can prepare themselves, you know, to play in competition more efficiently.
I could talk to you about USC football for a long time, but I'm not going to. it's interesting. Do you get the sense, at least I think this way, at least from what I hear from people, and I keep reading the statistic that scores haven't changed. Technology changes and has improved, but scores haven't changed over the years in golf. Is that because golfers practice less than any other sport? They just go out and play?
Well, that could be one of the factors, Fred. But I think the other factor is that I think that golfers could really upgrade the way they practice.
It's the quality of their practice.
It's the quality of their practice.
Interesting.
Yeah, we contend, and we talk about it in the book, that there's three ways to practice golf. One is that you can practice your technique. You can work on your swing, and that has a valuable place. Doesn't prepare you, you know, directly for competition. It's just working on the swing, working on technique. Like today I'm going to work on learning how to fade the ball. Or today I'm working on my, I have a new setup, working on my posture. Or I'm going to work on my swing plane, et cetera. Okay, that has a value place.
But you need a coach for that kind of stuff. You just can't go out to the driving range and say, I'm going to change my posture today.
No,
that's
you
probably
really
a dangerous thing.
Yeah, you need an enlightened swing coach that you that can lead you the way and show you, you know, how you possibly can, you know, prepare yourself and practice things that you might discover, you know, and learn in a lesson, you know, with a good teacher. But this is the way that most people practice. Let's say that Fred Green is practicing today, and he goes out and he's hit 57 irons, and after, you know, about 10 of them, he gets a nice little rhythm going, and he starts hitting some really nice shots. Then at the first hole, he's got 150 into the flag, and he has a 7-iron, and he misses it. He says, well, what's wrong here? I just hit 40 really nice 7-irons, you know, on the range. Why can't I hit this one? Well, the reason is that because you didn't practice correctly. You know, that working on your swing with the 57-irons is okay, but the next thing you need to do is simulate competition situations. And you simulate them by, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my 7-iron and I'm going to change my target and my direction on every shot. And if I'm skilled enough, I'll change the shape of the shot each time. Or I'm going to change my club on each shot, have a different target, different direction. Like I have my whole bag there. And I'm going to hit a 7-iron to this flag, then I'm going to hit a 5-iron, I'm going to hit a driver, then I'm going to hit a wedge, and there's no repeats, much like there is when we play in competition. So if we miss the shot, we have to move on to the next shot, you know, and we have to use our, you know, I'm getting ahead of myself, but we have to use our pre-shot routines and our post-shot routines, you know, as we simulate competition situations. So we can practice technique. We can also practice and simulate competition situations. And I know, I think that's chapter 8 or 9 that talks extensively about how to do that. And I think it's really, really important.
Now I want to get into the book a little bit more. And the thing that I want to concentrate on in your book, you have two things that really jump out at me that I think are very important for me.
Okay.
And that is the pre-shot and the post-shot routine that you suggest. Since I've read the book, I've tried to incorporate a post-shot routine, but I always remember that I'm supposed to incorporate my post-shot routine after I've already put my club back in the bag and I'm, like, trying to think about the shot or what I'm supposed to be doing next. It's like, oops, I forgot I'm supposed to do a post-shot routine. Let's start with a pre-shot routine and the importance of it and how to create one for yourself.
What we decided about 4 years ago at we call a pre-shot routine the SAT, and how this came about, and I tell a story in the book, is that I was doing a workshop with a Carmel High School boys team, and I said pre-shot routine includes these ingredients. One, number one, you must have a strategy that you can totally commit to, and the strategy must be something that fits your game. In other words, if you haven't hit a fade in a month, it's probably not something you're going to decide to do out here. So you determine the strategy. It's 152 yards of the flag, and my target is the center of the green, and I'm going to hit my natural draw into the center of the green. I can totally commit to that. Okay, so that's the strategy. And the strategy is really developed with consciously thinking about what you're going to do. So you make total commitment. The second thing is aiming. You have to aim your club face to your target line. You have to have your body lines organized, parallel left, your ball position, and et cetera. And you must aim your imagination after the target. In other words, let's see the shot. You know, let's see the shot before we hit it. And then the third component is trusting. Trusting that you're totally committed to the strategy, trusting the fact that you're aimed, and just trusting your swing. So SAT is how we prepare to get the shot. Now, pre-shot routine has been talked about over and over again and in many periodicals, but it's just really essential that we have a well-defined pre-shot routine. Now, physically, it works like this. Typically, a person stands behind the ball where they make the decision on their strategy, 152, center of the green. Then they walk, four steps, three steps, two steps up into their address position. And at that time, their conscious mind is quiet and they're seeing the shot and they're beginning to feel a swing that matches what they see. And then they aim and they making sure that they keep their imagination out to the target. In other words, continue to see the shot, feel a swing that matches what they see. And then after the last look at the target, to trust what they see and feel. And so that's how the pre-shot routine works. And it gives you the best chance, doesn't guarantee great shot, but it certainly gives you the best chance to trust the swing that you have.
And you believe that it really does separate the quality players from the lower quality? I don't know how to be gentle about this, but the better players from not, is a lot to do with their pre-shot routine?
Yeah, I know that the pre-shot routine gives you the best chance, whether you're a PGA Tour player, LPGA player, or if you're a 18 handicapper that plays twice a week. You got to have a pre-shot routine because that gives you the chance to trust, a better chance to trust the swing you have. And it begins, as we begin to repeat, you totally commit to the strategy, set your aim, which means your body and the club face and your imagination, and then, trust the strategy you're committed to, and trust your aim and trust your swing. I think it's essential. And of course, if you're going to do that in competition, then you need to practice your pre-shot routine, when you're on the range, so that you're more apt to do it when you're playing out on the golf course.
You're friends with Fred Shoemaker, correct?
Yeah, I know Fred well.
And in his book, An Extraordinary Golf, we talked to Fred a couple episodes ago. He was not so much of a routine. He didn't like the idea of routine.
Well, then, as I have said to Fred, then he doesn't necessarily understand it. See, routine, the only reason we have a routine is so that when we take the last look at the target, we take a tension-free swing. We allow our swing to come out tension-free. That's the reason that we have this preparation. You see, if you can commit to a strategy, you have a better chance of trusting your swing. If you can really set up an aim, not only your body lines and your imagination after the target, you have a better chance of trusting your swing. And the reason that we go through the F and the A is so we can get to the T so we can trust the swing we have. Now, routines, some people do them in 10 seconds and some take 20 seconds. But the essential part of it is when a person takes a last look at the target so that they can sense the swing that you're going to use in advance, so they can really feel the swing that matches what you see. And that's why we do routines. And I would think they would totally agree with Fred's approach. Then the most important thing that a person, when it steps up there, they have feel some freedom, that the tension is out, that we can really allow our swing to go to the target. So I think we probably agree. It probably depends on how we define, the pre-shot routine.
Now, let's talk about a post-shot routine. That is unique.
Yeah, well, it is. I think that's a niche, and that's why we bring it up at the front part of the book. Is lots of discussions about pre-shot routines, but a post-shot routine is just as important. It's how we process the shot. And, okay, let's say that we step up and we trust it, and the 152-yard shot, and we hit that 7-iron right in the center of the green. So we pose, and the first thing we do is we record it emotionally. Wow, man, did I like that one. And the second thing that we do is we record the feeling of the swing. And we record the feeling of the swing that goes to our long-term motor memory. And so we're ready for the next shot. So we're absolutely refocused. In fact, we can hardly wait to get to the next shot. Okay, so now, how about if we miss the shot? The first thing we do is, let's say that we're lined up that 7-iron, and like my friend Frank, we pull it to the left and we miss the green. And the first thing that we must do, and I think I borrowed this from Extraordinary Golf, we must suspend judgment. That first 2 or 3 seconds after we hit the shot is absolutely essential that our mind is still clear. Whoops, I pulled that one. Okay, let's see now. I go back to my SAT. Well, you know, I wasn't really committed, you know, to that shot to the center of the green. I was still trying to wonder if I was going to fade it or draw it. Okay. Okay, take the swing that you wanted to take. Take it right then. All right, what I've done then is I haven't sent any negative emotions to my emotional memory. And what I've given my long-term motor memory is a feeling of the swing that I really wanted to take. So now I've reviewed what I've done, I've replaced it, and I've refocused, and I'm ready for the next shot. The key thing there is the suspending judgment. There's no such thing as a bad shot as a terrible shot. All there is, well, I missed that one, and the reason is either I wasn't committed, my aim was off, or I didn't trust my swing, or some combination, you know, of the SAT thereof. And that post-shot process is so important because it gives us the opportunity to refocus for the next shot. As a friend of mine that was reading the book, and he said, you know, that's the most important thing that I have learned. If I can learn to not judge my shot, you know, so I miss a shot. Say, God, what a terrible shot. Now, we already know that. So why don't we give ourselves some information that really means something? Like a good teacher. A good teacher, if you miss your shot, and wouldn't say, oh, man, Fred, that was a terrible shot. What they might say, were you committed to that one, Fred? How much do you feel any tension in your swing? You know, actually, your aim is right where you hit that one. And so we may need to treat ourselves the way a really good, enlightened teacher and give ourselves the same kind of information, you know, the teacher would give us. So how am I doing on the post-shot routine? We're making some progress?
Yeah, and I love the idea of, the whole thing about trusting your shot. I know that I've played with people, and I'm guilty of it as well, as I feel like, okay, I've been pulling my driver all day, pull, so I better make some adjustments where I better open, you know, my club head. You know, making adjustments during a round of golf, I guess, is a kiss of death, and it means you're not trusting anything that you're doing.
Well, the trap sometimes we get into is what we say is this. During competition, you never fix a swing. You just fix the way you execute the swing.
Hmm.
And that's important. There's time to fix your swing, but it's certainly not in competition. And because the swing we have, I mean, I guarantee you, Fred, if you're going to play today, you know, the swing you have is one you're going to use. So you might as well learn to use it. And you learn to use it by having a pre-shot routine, which is strategy, aiming, and trust. And you learn to use it by processing. You're going to miss some shots. Certainly, and everything is relative. A pro hits it 10 yards offline, that's a miss hit. And depending on our index, you know, we may miss a little bit far offline, further offline. What we have to do is to stay with the way that we execute shots. And we do that by managing our emotions and by using our SAT on every shot as we prepare and every shot as we process. And that way we're going to give ourselves the best chance to enjoy the game and to shoot, you know, as low a score as possible.
And that is the goal.
That is the goal. Both those things. We, you know, like the we have double goals when we play. We certainly want to shoot a low score.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is we want to have a great time. And so, you know, things in winning the battle within will lead us in that direction and give us ways in which we can maximize the opportunity for lower scores and more enjoyment.
It's interesting because I went out and played nine holes this weekend, and when I came back, and I wasn't starting off really well. I was actually pretty awful, but I ended up pretty well.
Oh, wait a minute. Just back up again.
Okay. My scoring was awful.
Awful's not good enough. You know, it's that didn't tell us anything.
Okay.
You might say to yourself, I shot a score higher than I expected.
Yes.
But let's be more specific than that.
Tell us. Do I have to?
Yeah, you do.
No, come
on,
please.
That's the way you suspend, because you just judge it by saying awful. We have to clean up our language and say what I was doing is, did you have tension in your swing? Were you committed to your shot?
No.
Were you distracted? What was the distraction? And that's the way we have to work through that. We have to get past the judgment. You know, it's like Pete Carroll says. Okay, so he coached in New England, and Bledsoe is his quarterback, right? So he tells a story, throws an interception, comes off the field, and he wants to explain. You know, well, Terry Glenn, he says, well, wait a second, Drew, what's the next play? So immediately, if you suspend judgment, you can leave that behind and you can get back into the present so you can really give yourself the best chance. So telling me that you had a horrible day wasn't anywhere near enough information. You have to tell me more. How's that?
That helps. That helps because the point that I was going to make is that when I came home from trying to forget about this, when I came home from the round, my wife and even one of my kids, when I was talking to him on the phone, said, did you have a good time? And I said, and I thought for a moment, well, let's see, I didn't score very well, but hey, I was out playing golf. Yeah, I had a great time because I got to be out there.
Well, that's good.
So that helped. And I think that I was carrying that through me is why I was able to improve my attitude, I guess it was, because like I said, when I first started the first couple holes, I was just not performing the way I had. I was not performing up to my expectations. But then it improved throughout the day, and I was making better shots, and I was feeling better about it, and I was definitely committing to it more. There was definitely a lack of trust in the beginning. It was bizarre, but...
Well, see, now that's really, really good information. We can really go from there. You know, and we'd say, okay, so the next time then that you play, let's see if we can bring the commitment and the trust, you know, right into the first shot. And so even back it up more, when next time you have an opportunity to practice, let's practice trusting your swing. And let's practice commitment. And those things can really be practiced. And, you know, those drills that one can use in order to just practicing trusting your swing. Anyway, so that's what I recommend.
Tell me about the three stages of motor learning.
Yeah, this we bring in some scientific stuff. And I think it's just absolutely essential that not only golfers, you know, understand, you know, what the stages of learning are, but all teachers, you know, as well. So these are the stages. Let's say that the first stage of learning a new skill is what we call a cognitive stage. You know, we're bringing a big word, but if, say, we're learning, we're going to learn a flop shot. You want to learn how to, you know, to hit the ball way up in the air with your 60-degree wedge to a tight pin. Okay, so in the process of doing that, your instructor will say, might demonstrate, you know, how to do it if they're able to do that. And they'll give you some information like open up your stance, lay the club open. Let's lay the club open, and I want you to swing a little bit more upright than you've been swinging. And so you can slide that club right under the ball. And so then you start doing it, and the feedback you get is external. In other words, the golf pro would say, okay, that's it, a little bit more upright, open up your stance a little bit more, and the information you're getting external, and you've got to think about it. You have to think about how to swing, how to lay the club open, and et cetera. So that's the first stage. I don't know how long you stay there. It depends on the enlightenment of the teacher and how complex the skill is and how motivated you are and how much you practice. But the second stage is associative, and it's exactly what it means. You're still getting feedback that's external, and you might watch yourself on videotape, but you're getting to get some internal feedback, and this is really essential. You might turn to your teacher and say, hey, yeah, I'm beginning to feel that. Beginning to put it in your long-term motor memory. Beginning to, hey, let me show you. And then you say, yeah, you're getting it. Then you get to the third stage, and they call it autonomous, but it just means it's automatic. And so now you've learned the skill, and you're out there, and you've missed a green, you short-sighted yourself to the right, and you got to hit a flop shot, and you look at it, and you look at the shot, and right away you begin to feel the swing, and you automatically step into the right setup, and you lay that club open, and you take that nice upright swing, and you do it without any conscious thought at all, because now it's in your long-term memory, and it's automatic. Like Joe Montana, takes, one step, three step, five step drop. He's not thinking about his throwing motion. He's looking at the target, and he's just throwing automatically because he's practiced through repetition, repetition, repetition. So our goal is to get to the stage three, which is playing automatically. And I don't know how long it takes to get there, but I know we can get there through the right kind of practice. And I know once we get there, then we can just practice trusting that flop shot. Those are the three stages, and I think it's really, really important that enlightened teachers move a student through those three stages to the point where they get to the point where they notice that the player can do this without any external feedback from them, because all the feedback they get is from themselves. They can really feel the swing. They can feel it in advance. They can feel the setup, and they can feel, trusting the swing. So those are the three stages, and I think it's really important that people understand them, and that teachers understand them as well.
You've provided a lot of information for us to absorb today, Glenn. The book is called Winning the Battle Within. The perfect swing is the one you trust, and the author is Dr. Glenn Albaugh, spelled A-L-B-A-U-G-H. Glenn, tell us where we can find the book.
Well, it's Glenn Albaugh and Michael Bowker, B-O-W-K-E-R. It's a small publishing company, Kell Publishing, K-E-L-E publishing.com, and you can buy it online right there. That's how you can get the book.
Glenn, thanks so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you, Fred.
Golf Smarter now presents Nick's Picks with Kenny Nicholson, sales manager for EdwinWattsGolf.com. Kenny keeps us up to date with reviews of new products and new product development. Nick's Picks is brought to you by Edwin Watts Golf, golf's most trusted retailer since 1968.
Hey, Kenny, how was your weekend?
My weekend was actually awesome, Fred. I had a great opportunity. Something that we get every now and then here at Edwin Watts Golf, to go visit the McGregor guys up in Albany, Georgia.
And why were you there?
I was there to look at some new products that they're going to be coming out with that I can't really touch on right now, because they're going to introduce them before I can. But I can tell you that there are some really neat things on the horizon for this company. We went up there to see them regarding some of those issues. Play a little bit of golf, I have to admit.
Good. So what did you see at McGregor that is tantalizing to us?
The most tantalizing thing that I saw was probably their Hall of Fame club maker, Don White, hand sculpt golf clubs. I've met Don a couple of times. Those of you that read into golf a lot, he's made golf clubs for some of the world's best players for a long time, Greg Norman, Jose Maria Lethabel, Steve Elkington, all of those guys. And I sat there and watched him make golf clubs for Aaron Baddeley. I mean, it was...
Oh, you weren't just having a conversation with the guy. You got to sit and watch him work?
Oh, I sat right there at his grinding wheel. Oh. It's right beside him, which was the most awesome thing, because I've heard about it a lot, and I've seen golf clubs made before, but not by hand, by somebody that literally, by the naked eye. And Aaron's clubs are not a traditional back to them. You know, it's not like a flat with weight on the bottom or weight on the top that are easy. You know, Steve Elkington's basically got all his weight on the bottom, and Greg Norman's basically has all his weight on the top. So it doesn't look like a very difficult forging process, but still... the way that Aaron Baddeley's are kind of deep cut in the back was amazing to watch this guy do this with no tools.
What do you mean with no tools?
No tools. He does it by hand.
What does that mean?
He just sits there on a wheel, a grinding wheel, and holds the club up to it and cuts the way that he wants the weight distributed in the back of the golf club. He does it by hand and uses no tool whatsoever, just blind eye. And if you ever have a chance to see what the back of his clubs look like, you'll understand what I'm saying. It's not an easy process for Aaron's clubs. I mean, it's a very difficult task. And at one point, he had got the club, he measures the total gram weight, and they also have the shaft already gripped. And while he's making the club, he sticks the head on there and makes sure that the swing weight is where he wants it at all times, because it has to be D3. So,
what do you mean it has to be D3?
Well, that's what Aaron wants his clubs at. He wants them to be at D3.
Well, so, I don't know what D3 means.
D3 is a swing weight, is what they use. They put it in a swing weight machine where you've got all the pressure on the grip and the toe or the head itself hangs off, and it tells you what the swing weight is going to be. And then for, you know, most, like, stiff shafts, going to be D1, D2, or D3 is a little heavy for most people. Shaft has some to do with that. But at one point he had the golf club. It was 287 grams, and he's made his golf clubs enough. He's like, he wants them 254 grams. And to watch him take weight out of this golf club in the areas that he needed to take it out of, it was – I've been doing this for 13 years, and I've been to several plants and seen golf clubs made. But to see this done, you know, was incredible.
Oh,
I mean,
man.
It was truly amazing.
So how much time does he have to spend with Aaron Baddeley?
Does he spend that
time on the course with him? I mean, how does that work?
He's not the one that does that. He'll make a golf club. Aaron will tell him, you know, basically what he wants or kind of how he wants it. They'll make a raw club. He'll hit them. You know, they'll get the fine-tuning process done. And then when the golf club is actually, when they make the golf club the way that he likes it, he'll just, you know, every now and then he'll call up and say, hey, look, I need to get another set made, and Don knows exactly how to make them. He doesn't have to see the old club. That's what's crazy about it. It's just amazing. And it takes him from start to finish, it takes him 4 days to make the whole set for him.
To make a whole set, okay.
To make a set of irons for Aaron. He said it's because, you know, the grinding process.
Is that a long time or is that quick?
To hand grind a set of golf clubs, to me, that's fairly quick.
Oh, wow.
You know, they... You know, and he was making some. Also, he had some there for Steve Elkington, and I want to say that he had a set there that he was going to be doing for Norman at the same time. But he had all their blades out there that they use, you know, showing them to us, the blanks.
And is this something that you're going to be putting on your Next Picks column in the EdwinWattsGolf.com?
It is. I'm going to feature. They have this 360-degree cup. Based technology they use on all their products. It's not, you know, something they use on the driver and then different technology on other products. It's called 360 degree cup face technology. I'll put it this way, the whole face of the golf club is a sweet spot. There's no weld. There's no cutout or insert that's welded to the face. They have a proprietary plasma welding process they use. The whole face is one piece. It's a very neat process, and I'm doing a Nick's pick on that this coming week, and something I'd like to feature with you as well in the coming future.
Oh, absolutely. And just if people aren't aware of what we're talking about, if you ever go to EdwinWattsGolf.com, and if you haven't by now, slap your wrist. There's a feature, there's a segment in EdwinWattsGolf.com called Nick's Picks, and that's basically what we've put this program together about is what Kenny does, and he reviews clubs every week. And so if you want more information about clubs before you make a purchase, you should definitely read his column, because it really is enlightening and informative on what you can get out of it before you make your purchase. I'm curious, McGregor, where do they fall in line of their competition? Like, and if we were to compare it to cars, for instance, are they on the Yugo side? Are they on the Rolls-Royce? Are they Porsche? Are they Mercedes? Are they Lexus? Are they Ford? I mean, where is McGregor?
I would put them in. I would literally put them in the Mercedes, the Cadillac group. They're not a Ford. They're not a Yugo for sure. They spend a lot of money.
I haven't seen them at Costco, so I guess.
No, I mean, they do make a lower brand, like every manufacturer does for the most part. But they're top end, like the NVG2 products that we'll talk about in the future. I'm just going to tell you right now, I've hit every golf club out there, and I would put them up there with every golf club out there. I mean, they just make such a good product. The grinding process that I'm talking about, that Don White does, if money is not an object for you, you can have a set of golf clubs hand grinded for you. There's a fee to it, but I mean, and it's not too terribly expensive.
And what does that mean?
I want to say
I'm really curious about this. What kind of numbers are we talking about?
It's right around, I want to say it's around $2,000, $2,500, but you'll have a hand-grinded set of golf clubs.
That really isn't that bad for a set of golf clubs. When I was at the PGA show, one of the Japanese manufacturers was telling me that Donald Trump paid $25,000 for a set of clubs.
I mean, for him, it's no big deal, and it's
obviously
hard to say who might have done those for him. You know, there's some manufacturers out there, a lot of international companies, that their golf clubs cost a lot of money.
It was Hanma.
Hanma is extremely expensive. $25,000 for them is nothing.
Oh, because
they have.
I actually got to hit some.
Yeah.
And it was, I mean, on the first swing, and I hadn't warmed up, I hadn't done anything, and the first swing was like, oh, my God. Gosh.
They actually use, believe it or not, they use diamonds, crushed diamonds, and gold wrapping on the shafts and stuff. In Asia, there's a lot of...
And the guy wouldn't give me a sample.
In Asia, it's a lot of status quo.
Yeah.
Unlike, you know, here there's some, but it's not near like it is over there. You know, you'll spend, I've sold $25,000 to $4,000 drivers from Hanma. So many people want to play that brand to be part of...
Oh.
The whole group of golf. I mean,
but you just don't see it here in the States.
You do not, no. A lot of people out there that are listening right now probably never even heard of Hanma.
No, I didn't know what the guy was talking about when he started talking to me, and I was just fascinated by it.
Called H-O-N-M-A.
Yeah.
Hanma.
Exactly.
They make a great product, but you are going to pay a pretty penny for it.
Absolutely.
You know, to get a set of golf clubs made here, and it's handmade in the USA, right here in Albany, Georgia, it's a pretty inexpensive price for some out there to have something. I mean, you can have the toe, the heel, the top line, everything grinded the way that you want it.
And McGregor product is all available at Edwin Watts Golf.
Absolutely.
We keep telling people edwinwattsgolf.com/golfsmarter is a great entry port so that you can get your discounts and you can get your free shipping. But you can also go to golfsmarterpodcast.com, and we've got a banner for Edwin Watts right on the top there. If you click that, it'll send you right into our portal page, which will give you the instructions on how to get free shipping on any purchase that you make. And also, we still have some time left, right, Kenny, on the 10% off on all your apparel. That ends on September 30th, and our next program will announce what the October special will be, correct?
That is correct.
And let's also say that we're still giving away a Bushnell X500 rangefinder valued at $200, that if you send an email with the subject Bushnell to pickme@golfsmarterpodcast.com, we'll have our drawing on October 10th. Your deadline is October 9th. Anything else for us, Kenny? It sounds like a phenomenal experience. And
it was an incredible experience.
Yeah.
I thoroughly enjoyed it in 13 years.
Thanks so much for sharing that with us.
Yeah, it was great. I wish everybody had the opportunity to go.
Yeah. Listen, I think this is so cool. There's this one jewelry company that's always had this slogan of, you've got a friend in the diamond business. It's very cool that we now have a friend in the golf business, because you're going to get some opportunities that we'll never get to know about, and we really appreciate you sharing it.
Yeah. Keep in mind, everybody, we're giving products away every so often. All you got to do is send in your email, and we will be giving something out to a lucky listener every couple of weeks. And I'm not, I mean, they're going to be nice products.
And even if you are, you know, you don't live in the United States, please enter, because Kenny has told me if you live in Bogota, Colombia, or in Australia, they'll ship it to you and they're not going to charge you for it when you win that prize. And American servicemen overseas, hey, we really appreciate the emails.
Yeah, send your stuff in.
Yeah, send it to pickme@golfsmarterpodcast.com. Don't forget the subject title this week. It's Bushnell, and you have two more weeks for that one, and we'll do the drawing and announce the winner. Don't forget to check out bunkershot.com, online golf magazine, for news articles and more. And we end with our quote of the week, which is submitted by you. If you have a favorite quote that helps keep your head in the game, send an email with a subject quote to fred@golfsmarterpodcast.com. And this week's quote comes all the way from the Netherlands, provided by Michelle Muyen, who says his favorite quote comes from Gary Player, which is, "The more I practice, the luckier I get." Thanks for listening to the Golf Smarter Podcast. I'm Fred Green.